KaiserNetwork.org.
Chairman and founder, Virgin Group Limited, Sir Richard Branson. Partner, Khosla Ventures, Vinod Khosla. CEO and co-founder, Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory Lovins. Presidential Chief of Staff, Government of Brazil, Dilma Vana Rousseff. And please welcome back the Honorable Carol Browner.
Thank you, and let me compliment you on your ability to change tables in an orderly fashion. That was rather impressive. This panel, if I might have your attention, will include simultaneous translation. You have headsets on your table. As I understand it, someone's going to correct me when I get this wrong. If you go to channel one, that will be the English translation for the minister who will be speaking in Portuguese. And the translation from English to Portuguese will be on channel two. Okay. Well, we've just, as you know, we focused on renewable energy. We are now going to turn to renewable fuels. And what I'd like to do is start with Sir Richard, because we were all here in this room thinking hard about renewable energy. We do not know the announcement that you just made, and perhaps you would begin this session by sharing with the group.
We're in the airline business. The airline business and the train business does its fair share of damage to the environment and putting out CO2. Basically what we've pledged today is that any profits we make from or dividends or share sales from the from our airline businesses or our train businesses will plow back into global warming and investments in this area, and hopefully it'll be something like $3 billion, all going well over the next few years. But
you can share some details if you'd like. We like the dollar amount.
I think I said $3 billion, but I've only woken up to the real potential catastrophe this world faces in the last 3 years. I think I read a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist about 3 or 4 years ago, which sort of put me off track somewhat. Since then, I've met many scientists about 9 months ago, Al Gore came to my home and said, look, you know, you're in a position where maybe you could make a grand gesture that could maybe encourage other companies to make grand gestures as well. At the same time, investing in renewable energy hopefully will make business sense as well. I think the only way that global warming is going to be whipped is if we can come up with alternative energies to oil and coal that are profitable. It's got to be sustainable. You can't just give the money away because there's only a finite amount of money. And if you're effectively taking on the oil and the coal companies, you've got to come up with alternative fuels that are going to be the fuels of the future. And that's what we will invest in looking for. We'll be investing in cellulose, ethanol as well as ethanol. We'll be looking at butanol. We'll be looking at the whole range of new fuels. We just made an investment with Vinod on my right. We'll be looking and seeking out the best and most inventive people. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Vinod. I think a $3 billion commitment is worth two rounds of applause. Vinod, if I might ask you to speak, you have a tremendous expertise and think about the issues of renewable fuels from many aspects. But if I might ask you specifically to speak about the tremendous surge, if you will, investment in corn ethanol, and is that really the right path to get us to cellulosic? If we agree that's where we want to go. If you could control all of the purse strings, what would you be investing in?
So corn ethanol is a great place to start because it reduces the market risk. It allows us to invest in cellulosic technologies, knowing that if you're successful in the technology risk, we'll have a market for our products. So it dramatically accelerates the amount of investment in cellulosic, and if corn ethanol didn't exist, we wouldn't have that. If you have the market established already, as we do, and we have the right policies to signal that this is a long-term stable thing, and by that I don't mean subsidies because I actually don't believe in subsidies. I think alternative fuels can compete unsubsidized with fossil fuel alternatives, and people like Richard who are making these investments will get great rates of return in unsubsidized markets. That's the opportunity I see, and corn ethanol is a great place to start. It gets us started. I very much suspect that as soon as the cellulosic technologies come in, corn ethanol will stop growing, probably not go away. Initially, they'll be done, cellulosic will be done in conjunction with corn ethanol plants. And then I suspect any spare corn capacity will go to restarting something new like bioplastics. So we're already starting to see people use low-cost feedstock like corn to get bioplastics started. 5-10 years from now, those will move to bioplastics from cellulosic. So I see corn as a good starting material.
Thank you. If I might now go to the minister, and again, there are headsets on your table. If you need translation from Portuguese into English, it's channel one. Madam Minister, perhaps you could talk a little bit. Your country's had a tremendous experience with ethanol. As you shared with me, it's been almost 30 years, three decades. But as you look forward, if you could share with us some of the thoughts of how you continue to grow that opportunity. Are there some potential downsides that need to be managed? What's the best way to manage those going forward?
Bom dia a todos. A matriz brasileira de
Brazilian matrix for biofuels experienced considerable expansion in the content of renewable fuels, particularly with ethanol. Brazil has 31 years experience with ethanol. For over 20 years now, no gas in Brazil is marketed without a content of 20 to 25% ethanol and as an additive to the gas. Now, we now have the development of 100% car using ethanol after the 80s, and we now have flex fuel cars, and they represent a very important part of the Brazilian fuel. We have 76% of the light sold in Brazil. We hope that by the end of 2006 we'll reach 2 million units, and next year 5 million. So much so that it is our belief that in the next year or so, no light vehicles will be marketed in Brazil unless they are flex-fueled. At the same time, I think it would be relevant to say that our learning curve has been considerable because we were able to increase the productivity and ethanol production in Brazil from a cost of $850, 850 cubic meter to $200 a cubic meter. Concomitantly, in terms of barrels, the production cost of ethanol in Brazil in terms of ethanol from sugar cane is at $32 as opposed to $75 for corn ethanol, $154 for the biodiesel from the European Union. In this sense, ethanol in Brazil has no subsidies. The only guarantee of supply is to have long-term contract for additives. In the event that ethanol is used in flex-fueled vehicles, in fact, the market regulation will ensure that as oil is higher than we use gas. When it's under it, we use ethanol. Now, there is a highly developed productive chain. We're talking about 50,000 growers, 365 refining plants for alcohol, and 16 billion liters of alcohol that's produced. Our view on the future is very clear. Two relevant issues to us are, in terms of R&D, we have lignocellulose and also the enzymatic hydrolysis for ethanol. So it's we are intent on increasing our production and use by using bagasse and also the straw. Concomitantly, we want to ensure that as we make advances in terms of adoption of seeds in Brazil according to the soil, we'll be able to get higher productivity. It is very important to point out that our future is really bright on a three-pronged fuel usage. One, ethanol, that we have already done, biodiesel of several oil plants such as soy, castor bean, palm oil, and aside from these three oil producing plants, we have in Brazil, Brazil has Petrobras, the national oil concern. We're also developing diesel based on vegetable oil. Forgive me. We are talking about including in the production line of the refining plants prior to the hydrogen injection in order to cut down the sulfur content, and we try to introduce vegetable oil in the content together with hydrogen and high pressure and high temperatures. We have a commercially viable production of biodiesel, very high quality. It is entirely different from biodiesel, mind you. Biodiesel could be added to this product. This is the second prong. Together with cellulose research, we'll be in a position to have, in Brazil, a biofuel industrial base that will be of considerable size.
Thank you.
Muito obrigado.
Sure, there are a number of questions that we'll like to follow up on, but let me first go to Amory. And Amory, let me ask you to speak to what maybe the environmental impacts. Are all biofuels created equal when we start to think about the environmental impacts?
Biofuels differ quite widely in their CO2 impact. Some, if you do them badly, could be slightly harmful in this regard. Corn ethanol is a net energy yielder if done properly, as you have to do if you want to make a profit consistently. But you can get about a 8 times or so better net energy yield with a more advanced cellulosic-based ethanol process made of woody, weedy stuff like switchgrass, poplar, elephant grass, crop waste. The more complex impacts that are harder to judge are in where we get the feedstock. There we need to look at land use, soil fertility, and for this reason, the cellulosic ethanol is of particular interest. You can grow corn sustainably, although most of it isn't done that way. In our classic corn culture 20 years ago, growing a bushel of corn took 2 bushels of topsoil, and we can't do that long. For example, switchgrass is a prairie grass, a prairie perennial, and you could actually make enough of it if you have efficient vehicles to run the U.S. system just based on the conservation reserve lands where we pay farmers to grow nothing. More precisely, we pay them to plant an annual cover crop, and then we penalize them if they harvest it. But the switchgrass with 2-meter roots will hold the soil a lot better than those shallow-rooted annual cover crops. So you can satisfy the conservation reserve land purpose of arresting soil erosion and at the same time be able to harvest this crop. And if you then co-crop it with nitrogen fixers, which is, of course, what happens in the natural prairie, sponsoring its own fertility, then you wouldn't even need inputs. So I think polyculture of perennials is going to be quite attractive. In Brazil, of course, there are different issues of land use, which perhaps the minister can address later on. And I think worldwide, this is the early stage of the industry at which we need to sort these issues properly and not end up with environmentally or socially and culturally unsustainable practices later.
Right. It's always, I think, important to be mindful of not only the intended consequences, but the unintended consequences. Let me go back to Sir Richard and maybe Vinod. You have a, I don't know if it's fair to call it a joint venture, but the fuels program, there's been a capital investment. And I'd be interested in hearing from both of you, what will be success? How are you thinking about this? Obviously a return on the investment, but where do you see this in 3-4 years? What will make you feel like this was a good venture?
Must be the first time we've talked as partners, so we see whether we agree with each other or not.
That's why we brought you here today, to make sure you...
First of all, I think both of us have been fortunate that we've made good monies in other businesses, so we can afford to stick our neck out and take some risks with some of the money we've already earned. Investing in alternative fuels... obviously, you are vulnerable to fuel prices collapsing, or conventional fuel prices collapsing, and the alternative fuel industry has, in the past, been damaged, from that happening. And with global warming, with the threats, the Middle East, reliability on the Middle East, and maybe all the funding that goes to farmers anyway. There could be a way that the government could consider having a sort of maybe a $45 insurance policy, and maybe them then taking some of the profits over, $60 or something. I mean, there are ways in which this industry could be protected. From Vinod and I'm in a sense hedged because I'm in the airline business and I'm in the train business. So if fuel prices collapse, I'm okay. But for a lot of people who go into this industry, there are risks attached. So governments, if they want enormous amounts of money invested in this industry, they may need to try to think of something like that. Mm-hmm. The other thing they certainly should do, whatever happens, and that is, really be encouraging E85 cars. And in fact, every new car should be E85. It only costs manufacturers about $100 in a new car to do that. They must encourage petrol stations, so the oil companies, or force the oil companies to supply ethanol in at least sort of 1 out of 3 or 1 out of 2 of their garages in a particular area. So it's moves like that from government which will, I think, protect the industry.
And your partner?
we had a great dinner at Davos in January this year, which was really a lot of fun and sort of a melding of the minds and how we sort of thought about this whole area. Since Richard has covered the general concepts, let me cover the specifics of this particular investment and sort of tell you why you shouldn't have predisposed notions of what even corn ethanol is. So these particular plants in California are destination plants, different than Midwestern plants, and they're about half the energy consumption in their production compared to a normal corn ethanol plant. So they're substantially greener to begin with, for lots of good reasons, also saves money in terms of they're cheaper to produce the ethanol. So you get greener and cheaper, and those two generally in this business go together because most of the cost comes from using energy. So if you save energy, you do pretty well. My hope is that these corn ethanol plants then become platforms in which you add on and bolt on cellulosic technologies, and over time, you make a transition. While doing that, you've already established the market, the distribution channels, all that, and the goal clearly is to build one of the leading companies, and I know everybody claims that, but the thing to keep in mind is there's so many opportunities, and this market is so large. that there will be more than one company, and there'll probably be a half a dozen great companies built in, starting from just corn ethanol, and then there'll be the cellulosic add-ons in addition to that. So, but this particular investment has a slightly different model of plants. It's destination plants as opposed to Midwestern plants.
Thank you. I want to, several of our panelists have talked about the role of government in this effort towards renewable fuels. And I think, Vinod, you suggested that there shouldn't be subsidies. I think the minister spoke about the role of government to some extent. I want to explore that a little bit more. And Madam Minister, if I might start with you in terms of your experience, what do you see as the single most important thing for the government to do to stimulate this market?
I believe that on ethanol.
Nós hoje no Brasil vivemos uma fase de absoluta desregulamentação. O etanol tem preços livres. Por quê? Porque todos.
Can you hear me now? Yes, okay. Tá certo. Ethanol has today in Brazil a characteristic that it is fully deregulated. We have a free pricing system, and the productivity of ethanol in Brazil, and we should point it out, that it's a product that when we started the program around 1975, the average of productivity was 47.78 tons per hectare. And the average today of the ethanol production is about 74.29 tons per hectare. That is, we basically doubled the productivity. And this is what explains the fact that, and also take into account that the energy balance from ethanol compared to the corn one is much more effective. It's about 3 to 4 times more advantageous to have the ethanol from sugarcane. The price of ethanol in Brazil is extremely competitive with gas prices. So there is the interference of government in this area is only in the area of additives in order to assure, since we don't have in Brazil gas without ethanol, we don't have it there, we assure average contracts of 1 year between distributors and resale and those who produce ethanol. For this aspect, for this sector, for the other ones, it's totally free. Why? Because if price goes up, we will use gas. If it goes up vis-a-vis oil, we'll use gas. If it goes down, we'll use ethanol. Ethanol also can, on each crop, be measured compared to the sugarcane production. So there is a logic, a trade logic, a commercial and economic logic in the productive chain of ethanol, because it's there for 31 years, and all the substantive part that we produce of ethanol today in Brazil, some 90%, we consume. So, and we can increase to 30. We can change the amount that is produced when we see, for instance, a collapse in prices, international pricing collapse. Now, given that all of you know about the oil market, it's not very realistic to imagine that it will go below $32, at least in a consistent way and lasting way. 32. I believe that when we're talking about biodiesel, which is the fuel that's coming into the market now, we've had to produce incentive, to give incentives. What's the main characteristics of this incentive? It's make it mandatory to buy purchasing. And in 3 years, we launched the program 3 years ago with some expertise on biofuels. And by the end of these 3 years, we will be able to mix 2% of diesel to include, 2% of biodiesel within the oil-based diesel. This biodiesel, as I said, comes from castor oil, from soy, from palm oil. We also use residues of, we use the fat of cows and cattle. So we can imagine that when we define demand, the market will adjust. We wanted to provide a social aspect to the biodiesel program, so we had a policy of removal of taxes, of tax removal from the production of biodiesel, as long as it comes from family farms, small farmers, family farming. So this resulted in a growth of income in the regions, in the rural areas of Brazil. And I'd like to talk now about the land use. Biodiesel, for instance, we are producing, with giving priority, all the tax removal, all the availability of financing is geared to a region of Brazil which is called the semi-arid in the northeast, a quasi-desert area that has, however, many aspects favorable to castor seeds, because this plant does need irrigation in order to develop itself. So, and the issue of land use, I think it's a very sensitive question, and it has to be well understood. So I would ask for you to give me some additional time to explain the following. Brazil has 851 million hectares of land. Of that land, a little less than half, some 383 million hectares, are lands that are soil that can be used for agriculture. Of that part, only 3 million hectares are being used for the production of ethanol. That means 0.8% of the whole arable land in Brazil. So why are we developing a program of lignocellulosis using cellulose in the production of ethanol? Why is it so? Because when we do it, our productivity on the residues, bags and straw, will be increased in more than five times. This is why we're saying that in a sustainable way, Brazil is trying to develop its production of biofuels, because it will not only open a new market, but it will go already to the second generation, and there is a whole set of institutions, research institutions, that are dedicated to the strategic issue for us, which is lignocellulosis, enzymatic hydrolysis. We have the acid hydrolysis already with some development, but we are betting on the enzymatic hydrolysis and even a combination of both that's being tested by Petrobras.
The question that many people had about land use, and I thank you for sharing that with us. We only have a few minutes left, and I'm under tremendous pressure to keep us on time. After all, President Clinton has been managing to stay on time, and for those of us who had the opportunity to serve with him, that's a challenge to all of us. So, but I do want to give Amory just a quick second on the issue of the role of government, and specifically on safety net taxes, subsidies. We've heard a number of different things here today. If you could give us a quick view on that. I know it's hard to give a quick view on that.
I agree that the market should evolve under market discipline. And I think Brazil got back its initial pump priming subsidies 50 times over already from the oil savings, and between ethanol and offshore oil is now independent of oil imports. Sweden is heading the same way. We can too. I hope we get to that in the subsequent discussion. because it's a combination of biofuels and efficiency, there is an important role for government in supporting and not distorting the business logic that will lead this nation off oil at a fifth the price we now pay for it. But this means that the $32 that the minister was talking about, I think, is an unrealistic expectation, because the average price of getting the U.S. completely off oil is $15 a barrel. Therefore, if we have subsidies, as we do now for corn, it probably does make sense to graduate them according to world price, as Vinod and others have suggested, so that it prevents the Saudis from sweating the market and driving their competitors out of business, as they've done before.
Thank you. And actually, I think Vinod should get the last word on subsidies, because he's actually the first person who used the word in this panel.
So the main point I want to make is this industry, to get good rates of return for investors, doesn't need subsidies. Most of what I've recommended as policy is signals to Wall Street that this is a stable policy. And without subsidies, I think we can generate high rates of return. Most of it is related to signaling, the most important being mandating that some large percentage of the cars be capable of taking flexible fuels. So let me stop there and keep us on time.
I'll just let Henry Ford finish the conversation. I just found a quote yesterday. I had to use it. He said, he'd be turning over in his grave if he could see the large cars that are being produced now and coming towards global warming. But anyway, in 1925, he had the foresight to say the fuel of the future is going to come from fruit, apples, weeds, sawdust, almost anything. There is fuel in every bit of vegetable matter that can be fermented. Thank you.
Thank you. And on that, we will end this part of the session.
Thank you very much, panel. And as you folks know, the panel will now have about 25 minutes to look at the questions that you produce during their conversation. And you will now have those same 25 or 30 minutes to talk about two questions at your tables. This time, the two questions at the tables, again, I'm sure you've seen the pattern. We're always asking you one question about how can I promote more widespread use of renewable fuels? And this time, I think you're going to have a little fun with the second question. It's very broad and very open-ended. It's basically asking you collectively to report back to the panel what you think it will take to get the U.S. to end our dependence on oil, or frankly, what it will take to get the globe to reduce our dependence on oil. Again, if there are any tables that have only a couple people at them, we would recommend that you consolidate for your discussions. And if anyone had a headset that really didn't work, just let your facilitator know and we'll get you a new one. Enjoy. Okay, folks, please welcome our panel back. They've worked hard on your original set round of questions. And as soon as we get everyone's focus up here, Gus will toss some questions to each one of the panelists that came directly from you. And they'll respond to those questions until we're ready to hear the themes from your table discussions. Okay, thanks very much.
Welcome back. I'm looking at an entirely too long list of questions from the audience, but we will select a few, and then we'll have the themes from your discussions over the last half an hour. Enrique, does green public transport and development have to be publicly financed? What is the role for public-private partnerships?
Well, if there is one good area for government subsidies, is transport, because it has a very inelastic consumption. I mean, the fact that it would be free does not make people ride the bus or the train up and down all day long. So people consume the transport that they need, no more, no less. Yet, of course, I believe that in our case, for example, we only invest in the road for the buses. The buses are private, and it's a private operation, at least in most developing countries and most everywhere. But when buses belong to government, they are extremely inefficiently operated. In Bogotá, a publicly owned bus would leave the north of the city and arrive to the south with a different engine. So this is basically private contractors. This is private contractors who operate all the buses. 96% of the system's income goes to private operators, the bus operators, the people who operate the smart cars, in intelligent electronic smart cars, another company. I mean, different private people who share there. And in our case, we don't have any subsidies for the system. But yet again, as I say, if you have a rich enough society, I think it's a very good area to subsidize. In our case, we don't subsidize it because we cannot afford it, but I would like to subsidize it.
Thank you. Katharina,
yes.
What obstacles did you encounter in your efforts to green your city, and how did you overcome them in Stockholm?
Well, some obstacles that we meet is when we get rid of our garbage from the families. We want people to put them in the different fractions, you know, and we have very many fractions in Stockholm. We have uncolored glass, we have brown and green glass, we have paper, we have cartoon, we have metal, we have hard plastic, we have soft plastic, and I think maybe a couple more. And this is very difficult, and you cannot put anything with electricity in here, not with where you have when you put it in the wall to get electricity. I don't know the English word for it. But you cannot put that in there. So that is difficult for people to get rid of an old TV that doesn't work, or a refrigerator or something like that. Then they sometimes put it on the street near to those bins with the fractions. And sometimes they put fractions outside because they might be unsure what kind of plastic is it, or is it full in this bin. And that is drawing rats to the place, and people complain. And then we said it must be the responsibility for the producer to keep clean around those bins. And then the producers sometimes use spies, you know, with cameras, and trying to take pictures of who was putting what where, and number plates of the cars, and even going into maybe a sack that was not put in the different bins to see if could we find an envelope with a name to see who is, and maybe you read about the old lady that had a frying pan too big to get in the hole for metal, and she knew it was metal, but I think the handle was plastic, so she put it aside the bin, and she was photographed by a spy, and she was drawn to court. And she almost died because she was just a little bit too old to be prosecuted for something that she really thought she was doing right. She wanted to do this very well. So we have to, I think, politically see to that we don't have regulations that kill our citizens. Where shall we put the dead citizens that are killed for this? So there's lots of things we must do. We are overregulated in Sweden, I think.
Here is a good one for Rocky and Gavin. How does city action affect national action, and vice versa?
It's amazing what's being done in cities around this country. We have almost 300 mayors now throughout the United States who have signed on to the Climate Protection Agreement. Some 200 are now working with ICLE in really putting these commitments into action. ICLE has been a tremendous partner with the cities, helping us with the software to establish our baselines, measure our progress, provide information as to how we can continue our emissions reductions programs. And if this administration and this Congress isn't absolutely embarrassed by being left so far behind by the cities, then they're simply not paying attention. So I think the greatest impact is that we can demonstrate. Cities are great laboratories for innovation. By demonstrating, as cities are doing all over this country, that not only can we set these ambitious goals, but that we can meet them, and we can save money in the process, we can actually get it done. We have the means. All it takes is a political will. I think that's going to be the greatest contribution that cities have in moving federal public policy.
Let me just pick up on where Rocky left off. We're now extending those agreements across shores. We established a framework with the United Nations, the World Environment Day. The first time they had ever brought their World Environment Day to North America was last year to celebrate with other mayors from around the world what we're doing environmentally, but also celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of the UN from San Francisco. I keep reminding my friends out here that we're happy to take the UN back anytime the New Yorkers feel they've had enough of them. We still embrace the UN. That being said, we were able to establish some protocols with mayors from over 120 cities around the world, similar protocols that were established at the U.S. Conference of Mayors that Rocky was referring to. But let me just say and pick up, and I have no reason to mince words with the president and the lack of leadership. I've done it on almost every topic, so I happily will do it on this. It is an outrage in this country that we are not standing up and having real leadership on the issue of global warming. It is a disgrace. And the fact that cities across this country have to do the job in absence of that leadership is equally disgraceful. But the fact is we are doing it, and I'm proud of Rocky and everybody else that's standing up and to be held accountable. And just stop the rhetoric. You know, the bar is so low in America that I have a governor out there, Governor Schwarzenegger, that a year and a half ago was considered an environmental hero because he said he believed that global warming existed. Let me repeat that. He simply just stated that he thought global warming was real. And people said, my God, what leadership. And I thought, this is a problem just because he happens to be a Republican governor. I mean, give me a break. The bar is so low in this country, we've got to do a better job. And that ends my partisanship for the afternoon.
Senator Glenn, do you want to comment on this? David Sandiloff.
Well, it's my job to offer some nonpartisan constructive comments here. And they're an unbelievable number that were provided here at the table, just incredible, actually. And we grouped them on the first question about what steps can be taken into four categories. And the first was on transport. As you can imagine, there were lots and lots of suggestions on transport, making city fleets hybrids, building light rail systems and bike lanes, creating an intelligent bus service, as was discussed, and lots of other things in the transport basket. Lots of stuff on buildings, instituting fast-track permitting for green buildings, which we heard about in the first session also, enacting tax breaks for green buildings. Lots of suggestions on education. I love somebody suggested winning the hearts and minds of the city bureaucracy and building all of these issues into school curriculum, obviously, and using schools to take the lead by example. And then designing green communities, suggestions for reducing incentives and subsidies for sprawl, converting waste methane from landfills into energy, and planting more trees. So what incentives would help communities save more energy? There were suggestions for federal incentives for mass transit, for federal incentives for multi-use high-density housing, creating a cap-and-trade program among cities, organizing a clearinghouse of information about best practices so cities could share them with each other, recognizing and awarding public employees who create energy savings, similar to the same employee performance-focused suggestion we had in the first panel. And then an interesting idea to create sister city programs with a particular focus on energy efficiency. Several quotes that I thought were pretty interesting. Somebody said, on a kind of more sobering note, it's harder to retool a city than a company. I thought our panelists would enjoy somebody who said, mayors are the most credible messengers. And then finally, if the elders do not understand, educate the next generation. Thanks.
All right. There's so much brain power and experience and talent in this room that I'm sure that you could have written 10 times this amount in the time you had. But I want to ask the panel, how about responding to some of these points? Just pick out anything.
Well, I'd like to make a couple of comments.
Please.
First, bike lanes. Bike lanes are totally useless. You need protected, physically protected bicycle. Any bikeway where an 8-year-old child cannot feel safe is not a bikeway. I mean, like, Manhattan would be perfect. Instead of having all these cars parked along these streets, which are really not really solving any parking problem or anything, if you would take them at least out of one side, you could make a very, very bikeable city where distances are very short, it's flat. But I'd like to just to leave you one point of for thought. Developing country cities are going to be created. I mean, 2 billion new inhabitants over the next 30 or 40 years. But the growth will be much larger than that. Again, as I said, because homes will be smaller, because there are more institutional buildings as a percentage of the area built. So there is a huge challenge for the world there. And so one of the greatest challenges and relating to sprawl is how to avoid sprawl there. Because sprawl is beginning to happen there too, the same. Upper income people are going out to gated communities and all this. So I think this is because sprawl, density is really the solution to all. I mean, we cannot, more important than to decide where we want buses or trains or trams is to really have density. If you have density, you can have many different forms of public transport. You can have walking distances. You can have bicycles. Therefore, how to avoid sprawl? I think one of the ways of doing it is providing people in cities so those things they are seeking in the suburbs, such as a lot of green, a lot of pedestrian spaces for children to play safely. Why not think of hundreds of kilometers of pedestrian networks? For cities that are going to be built from zero, it costs nothing. It would be very easy. We really have to think different in the way we build cities. Who decided that we should not have, for example, one pedestrian street for each car street? For 5,000 years, all cities' streets were pedestrian only, or at least one pedestrian street for five car streets. So I think we can really think different, and there is a huge challenge out there to create dense cities, but which provide many of the amenities of the suburbs in much denser environments, which, because density really is the key to solving public transport and many of these issues that have been mentioned here.
Could I just make a short comment on education? Because I think it's very important, this, within the hearts and minds of city bureaucracy. In Stockholm, we had a group that had the task to make Stockholm cleaner and nicer. And they were coming from all fields, building houses, planning streets, social aid and everything. And they were bureaucrats, and they were led by a woman who had this task for about a couple of months to have ideas, what should we do. And it ended with a campaign, a very big campaign, directly to the citizens of Stockholm. For example, people throw very much litter on the street. Paper and all those bring your coffee thing with you. They just put it. When it's finished, they put it. Sometimes when it's not finished, they put it very nicely in the corner of a window of a shop or something like that, so it shouldn't spill on the street, but still the cup is there. So we have
need more regulation.
So then we had, more cameras. We are getting more cameras now, I can assure you. But then they had one idea that was very good. They put as information on the litter bags, where you can put the litter. they put a big sign. This is the nearest litter bin you have in Stockholm. So just information for people, you can put it here. I think that is very good to win their hearts and minds, because then we get lots of good ideas that goes straight to people. It's better than the politicians are on TV telling people not to throw litter around. And I think it's important also to have it in the school curriculum and schools led by example. And I think it should start very, very early, because kids of 2 or 3 years old, they go home and they really teach their parents what to do and what not to do. So I think it's important to start even in preschool, very important.
Rocky, in cities, we talk a lot about sustainability and good environmental practices, and yet we see the impact of a lot of our ordinances have been on the books for a long time, and some of the other interest groups like historic preservation folks that want things exactly the same, and we can be our worst enemies. There was a recent example of a gentleman who was willing to spend a significant amount of money putting in photovoltaic panels on his home in an area that is regulated by our historic preservation ordinances. And our planning staff gave him the hardest time because, God forbid, these photovoltaic panels would be seen from the street. Now, that was something I was able to resolve in about 2 hours after I read about it in the newspaper, because there was some discretion in our planning department. But we have ordinances that, for instance, prohibit white roofs. Now, that's been on the books for a long time, but we know that there are some very high-efficiency roofs now that save a lot of energy. And the color of the roof, you know, we have to weigh these things. So we recently, to address these things in a comprehensive fashion, created a very broad-based sustainability task force where we're bringing in architects, contractors, developers, and these city staff people who are dealing with these things on a daily basis to look at every one of these obstacles to sustainability and make some comprehensive recommendations as to reform of our ordinances. But I think we see this nationally, and I think that a comprehensive approach rather than battling these kinds of things on a daily basis is really what we all need to do. And all I can say is, especially with the great successes we've seen with high-performance LEED certification of buildings, we have got to put in place every incentive we can, including a rapid turnaround for permits and licensing and all of that, to encourage, to incentivize in every way that kind of building. And imagine if we did that on a federal basis, if we were to convert federal buildings, for instance, over 20 years old and make them all high energy performing buildings, we would not only create hundreds of thousands of jobs nationwide, it would be great for our economy, and certainly it would be great to help lead us toward energy independence in this nation. But in the cities, we've got to lead the way, at least for now.
Aaron, just to pick up on where Rocky, there's a lot of great incentives that are out there. Chicago's got some extraordinary incentives. Mayor Daley has really raised the bar in terms of fast-tracking solar. We have an over-the-counter $89 solar fee, which is very modest. I can assure you $89 to get a permit to put that solar up. We're doing the same thing with LEED buildings, particularly a LEED silver, gold, and platinum. Fast-tracking, notably starting at gold and platinum, fast-tracking those permits. So there's simple things you can do. On the issue of transportation, Enrique, boy, you are absolutely right. Just striping a lane for a bike is not a bike lane. One of the things that we're doing, and it's integrating both of the themes here, is that we're looking at those linkages. For example, we have building requirements in commercial buildings for showers. The reason we're doing that is because we want to incentivize the utilization of bikes. There is a direct linkage between the two. We now allow, and this was not an easy thing to do with some of my friends in labor, was to allow bicycle racks on the front of buses. to allow bicycles to be used on our ferry system. The idea, come in from another part of the bay on the ferry, you may take the light rail, you put your bike there, and then you may use your bike to get some exercise or get to a part where the transportation system is not as efficient. So the whole idea is integration, that sort of interdependence between all these multimodalities. Another thing we're doing is car sharing. We haven't really talked much about that. Why is it that everyone has to have a vehicle or be forced to have an inefficient, in many cases, public transportation option, which may not be an option at all? Some people need, especially in our city with those hills, where they have groceries and families, they're going to need that car. They're going to need the space to put those groceries in. They can't jump on the bus, and car share is a viable option. It's something we're seeing in cities across the country as well. One other thing that is exciting, and just a little tidbit, I was reading about a bicycle program in Lyon, France. Fantastic with the technology to get GPS tracking system in bicycles and get smart cards and swipe cards, and you incorporate them with a free bicycle program throughout the city of Lyon. We're doing, I have a new contract for our bus shelters coming out in San Francisco. This will be a requirement in that contract that if you want to advertise or provide the bus shelters in our city, you also are going to have to provide this similar type of free bicycle program, which is also an exciting way, incentive-laden, not burdensome from my perspective way, really advancing your alternative modes of transportation and advancing some of these issues on bicycling. And finally, there's an obvious linkage, too, with the outrageous realities of obesity in this country that we certainly need to encourage these type of recreational activities that obviously also provide transportation.
Thank you. We have just a couple of minutes, and I want to raise a different type of action that mayors take from time to time, and ask particularly our U.S. mayors to comment on this, as we've discussed it a little bit earlier. As many of you know, there are over 100 large coal-fired power plants on the drawing boards for our country. Very, very, very few of them have carbon capture and storage associated with them. So this is a projection, leads to these huge projections from our Energy Information Agency of future emissions in the U.S. The front line of this issue, the battle, which I think we see coming on these plants, is in Texas, the TXU Corporation is planning the equivalent of about seven large, 1,000-megawatt plants. David Hawkins is telling me it's up to 10. But the issue that is being joined by the mayors of Dallas and Houston, who have written all the other mayors in the state and asked them to join in a coalition to do whatever they can do, up to and including legal action against the utility to stop the construction of these plants. Are you ready for this, Gavin and Rocky, for these battles yourself? Have you already done something like this? You had to in your
well,
careers?
We just got a BlackBerry a moment ago in California. We just sued all the big auto manufacturers for the impact they've had on global warming. If you can sue tobacco companies, you can sue the gun manufacturers. Why not sue the automobile industry? And that's exactly what the Attorney General in California did this morning. So we have no problem with litigation in terms of moral adjustments and trying to encourage do the right thing.
Yeah, what a shame that it comes down to that, though. I think that the building of more dangerous, dirty coal-burning power plants, I think, is the greatest reflection of a lack of imagination, a lack of leadership on both the state and federal level. The fact that we've got mayors from Houston and Dallas doing this now, a year, 5 years ago, it would have been unthinkable. I think that sends a real signal to the power companies, to the regulators, to legislators. They need to start moving in another direction, because if they keep committing to coal, it's a very bad thing for them economically down the road, because the tide is turning dramatically. We're going to see, I think, renewable portfolio standards in every state, hopefully nationally, and the governor of the state of Utah just recently appointed a blue ribbon task force on climate change. I think that is a very good signal, even in a state like Utah, the reddest state in the country, by the way, and I'm proud to be the mayor of its capital city. There are a lot of those outside of our city boundaries who wish that weren't so. But when you file this litigation, there can be huge costs. I sued to stop a major highway coming into our community, to stop sprawl development, to stop more pollution coming in from funneling tens of thousands more cars each day. We prevailed in that lawsuit, but I can tell you our state legislature has put me at the center of their target every single session since then. But we need leadership. We need people who will stand up, because it will bring about these kinds of changes. And I'm proud to hear that both from California and Texas.
Could we have a round of applause for the panel? Thank you.